Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tiewald, and I'm here with
Peter R.H.
And we are your hosts for today's program. Last live one of the year.
Yeah, we're going to have... You always try to make something fake, like it's not a pre-recorded, I notice. I won't be on the next one because the station...
You're not supposed to pull back the curtain.
Oh, you can pull it as much as you want. I don't, what do you think these people are?
Well, we're live here right now.
Yeah, we are.
Even if we sound fake.
No, we sound very unprofessional right now, so it has to be live.
Okay. We have a good show for you lined up today. We're going to start off with... a report from Jesse Wentzloff about the new aquatic and community center down in New Westminster. It has won a design prize. We're going to talk about, we have a report from Nanaimo about the organization Options for Sexual Health, which is a sexual health advocacy and service organization with locations throughout the province, and they are facing the prospect of cutbacks that will mean they may have to close some locations. So we have a report on that. We have a long interview with from our correspondent Danny Nez for Adani about the Nalox Home Project, which is a project to teach high school students how to use naloxone to save lives, and a whole bunch more stuff. What are you talking about today?
Well, I've finally seen that Barbie movie.
Okay.
I'm a bit out of date at times with how I present. I mean, after everybody else talked about Henry Kissinger, I did a bit on him, for example. But I know that Robin, what's her exact position at the station?
Robin is our programming coordinator, so... She arranges all the programming and the hosts and make sure, you know, syndicated programs are in where they're supposed to be and supports programmers.
When did we have our workshop? It was in February of this year?
Yeah.
So I know that it was there that Robin told me that mm-hmm. she thought it was really good, the Barbie movie.
Right.
Well, I finally seen it, and I'll have a bit of a review of that film. And it put into context with a few other things. So.
All right. Cool. All that and some good music and good vibes.
I guess so.
Are we going to play a song from the Barbie movie?
No, let's spare the... I mean, actually, there's one thing. I was at a Tim Hortons. I said, this is one of the newer songs that are actually kind of good, and it was from that Barbie movie. That one about dancing in the dance all night or something. It's not bad. So if you can play that, I guess it's passable.
All right. Here is Jesse's report about the new aquatic center, aquatic and community center down in New Westminster.
New Westminster's Thomasout Aquatic and Community Center is turning heads and winning awards. The state-of-the-art facility, whose name Thomasout is the Hunkaminam word for Sea Otter House, has achieved a RHF Accessibility Certified Gold rating under the Rick Hansen Foundation's Accessibility Certification Program and won the Prix Versailles 2024 World Title Special Prize for an Interior in the sports category. The Prix Versailles is an award based on a review of architectural media from around the world, highlighting the most discussed projects within the architecture community. Paul Fast, principal architect for the firm HCMA, which designed the Thomasout Aquatic and Community Center, explains why Tummasout was selected as the 2024 winner.
Well, the project has achieved a number of notable firsts, which has really helped elevate it to a fairly prominent position in the media over the past few months. And so it's the first all-electric aquatic center of its kind, which is a whole new way of thinking about this typology of building. It's the first zero-carbon design aquatic facility in Canada. It achieved incredibly high standards for accessibility and inclusion through a number of design interventions. And so I think all of these things in combination really created a project that grabbed people's attention. And so it's been featured quite extensively in the media. And people are paying attention because they're looking for projects that are sort of defining what the future is of this building type in the design world.
As a public, community-oriented facility, the Tummasout Aquatic and Community Center sticks out from its competition, including large-scale projects like the Olympic Aquatic Center in Saint-Denis, France, and Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, home of the National Football League's New England Patriots.
I think it's a fantastic validation of the importance of this building type in sports architecture. Most awards programs, when they focus on sports buildings, tend to focus on the really large kind of mega projects and stadiums. And of course, those have their own kind of impact. But we know that recreation is incredibly important to communities, to the everyday life of people here in our country. And we know that these buildings play a crucial role in the kind of social fabric of communities. And so for this building to be recognized amongst those other really large scale projects is really satisfying and rewarding.
The building is also notable for its use of and relationship to the surrounding landscape, which Fast says is a great example of architecture that works with the land instead of against it.
It's actually one of my favorite parts of the whole story of the building, because if you look back at the original condition of that site, sort of pre-settlement or pre-contact, there was a ravine there which we named Glenbrook Ravine. And that ravine was a natural feature that had an ecology around it. The First Nations used it for various things. It was over, as settlement occurred, they put a 2-meter sewer line down the bottom of it and then backfilled it with all sorts of junk. And it really became kind of a symbol of the way in which we work against the land rather than with it. So one of the first steps for our building design process was to actually say, let's bring back the memory of that ravine because it was important and it was lost and it's worth recognizing. So rather than take the building and orient the building to the street grid, we said, let's turn the whole building so it faces the ravine. And it essentially, we're saying that the most important thing for this building is to interact with the memory of that ravine. And so we created this large public green space that is essentially the reincarnation at a surface level of that ravine landscape, and made all of the building windows face into it, all of the kind of key building alignments, circulation pathways feed into that kind of green space. And so some of the things we're learning from our Indigenous friends is that the principles around how you build with land as opposed to against it, that was one of the key moments. It also allowed us to, one of the other funny things about the street grid in New Westminster is it doesn't face perfectly north. And so if you build a building that aligns with the street grid, it will not face perfectly north. It faces about a 45-degree angle off. That becomes really important for a pool, because how you bring light into a pool is really important. You need to control it for glare and for lifeguarding safety, all those things. And so not only aligning the building with the ravine not only gave us a powerful connection to the landscape, but it brought in a north-facing light that was really comfortable and safe and really pleasant for people in swimming in the pool. So those are some of the strategies we used then when we say working with the land as opposed to against it.
A key reason for the city's Prix Versailles title is the focus on accessibility, which was also recognized through its achievement of an RHF Accessibility Certified Gold rating from the Rick Hansen Foundation's Accessibility Certification Program. Mayor Patrick Johnstone says the building, which is the City of New Westminster's largest capital project to date, was designed for people of all ages and abilities from the ground up, with accessibility in mind.
The city took an intentional approach to accessibility in this building. When we were doing the design work and the planning work with the community 5-6 years ago, the accessibility community talked about the importance of including accessibility at the design phase. Quite often you will build a building like this, you'll design a building, and then you will add on the accessibility elements to make sure that everyone has access to it. But we were intentional in starting right at the beginning with the design and having the accessibility community tell us what accessibility meant to them, and giving that to the designers, but then also including professionals who could bring an accessibility lens to every step of the design. So when it was still lines on paper, they could walk through that and actually look at the accessibility barriers and the challenges that we were creating before we created them. And the goal was, obviously, to get as close to universal accessibility as we could, but also to not have to tack things off after, to actually make it integrated into design so we save money and save time and start on the right step.
Centering accessibility and making it a key part of the Aquatic and Community Center's design is representative of the city's overall accessibility strategy, which includes in-depth community consultation and the consideration of intersecting and often contradicting accessibility needs.
Universal accessibility is the goal. It's very difficult to achieve because quite often if you design for some forms of accessibility to remove some barriers, you end up creating barriers for other forms. Things like creating very bright and vibrant color fabrics for wayfinding and such is great for people who might have visual disabilities, but it might also be a problem for people who have neurodiversity issues and may find too much sensory input, making it confusing for them to navigate a space. You try to design so that you can address both of those as best as you can and try to find the balance in that space. Some of the accessibility elements you can't add afterwards. There are things like the zero-step entry for the recreation pool that you just can't design in afterwards. It also took us a creative approach to address accessibility in the competition pool because you can't have a sloped entry into a competition pool, so we had to find another alternative that worked with the modern competition pool designs.
Brad McCannell is the Vice President of Access and Inclusion at the Rick Hansen Foundation.
There's all kinds of things the RHFAC professional will be looking for. But the other thing to recognize is that every site's different. Everybody's got a different goal in mind. The level of access provided depends on the occupancy on the site and the use of the building. So the assessor will come in and start looking for, certainly you have to meet code, you have to meet regulations, there's no doubt about that. How did you go above and beyond that?
McCannell explains that beyond providing ratings so that potential users can understand how accessible a given building might be, the Rick Hansen Foundation Accessibility Certification Program aims to shift the conversation around accessibility.
This is a cultural shift that we're looking for. This is trying to get everybody, the owner, the operator, the architect, the planner, the people swinging the hammers, to understand the old model, which is building a house or a building for 18 to 55-year-old males. That old model is not doing anybody any good because the moment you put up a building, it needs to be retrofitted. So that's killing your budgets, it's killing your sustainability rating, because I go in there and I tear everything out and drywall goes to the landfill. Understanding that what the RHFAC is actually doing is shifting culture, it's training architects, it's exposing them to ideas they haven't seen before, and most importantly, it's exposing them to the return on investment that's available.
Part of the reason for the Tummasout Aquatic and Community Center's success at achieving accessibility is that accessibility was a key focus from the beginning of the design process, instead of attempting to retrofit solutions once the center had already been built.
One of our real goals, part of the culture shift, is to move accessibility, move universal design, the practical application of universal design, to move that into the normal everyday design process. This is where the victories are. You look at sustainability, for example. In the 70s, sustainability was just an academic discussion around the table. But by the new millennium, the LEED program for sustainability had moved that into common everyday building process. And they did that by simple education, by having a course offered to professionals in the field that could be recognized as their normal professional development, and just brought them along, helped them understand the real issues around sustainability. They were able to take that concept, and instead of it being something you add at the end of a project, they had people, because it was part of their normal professional development, they brought sustainability to the water cooler, to the carpool, to the lunchroom. And that's what we were able to do with the RHFAC program, by having professionals take their courses, get the accreditation. All of a sudden now it's part of the discussion everywhere. It's not something you add after the fact, like it's landscaping. The thing about aging-in-place solutions, the thing about the practical application of universal design, it can affect everything if you let it. And so having it part of the process, the normal design process, not something separate, not something you do after, like it's landscaping, that's a really critical piece of the whole concept.
McCannell says that this kind of accessibility-centered design is hugely important and benefits everyone, whether disabled or able-bodied.
Able-bodied people, we call you TABS. See, we got names for you too. We call you TABS because you're only temporarily able-bodied. Doesn't matter if you do a face plant when you're a teenager and you end up in a wheelchair, or you're 75 and you need a walker and a hearing aid, you will be part of our community sooner or later. the largest minority group in the world and the only one that anyone can join at any moment. Fall down the stairs, an illness, a car accident, maybe you just get old. You're going to be part of this community. It's not us and them. It's just us. This is about me. It's about you. It's about your mom.
From the Thomas Out Aquatic and Community Center in New Westminster, I'm Jesse Wensloff for CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, reporting. This piece was made possible with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can find this piece online at frequencynews.ca.
And let's have a quick look at the weather for the coming week, Christmas week. Next couple days, today and tomorrow, are going to be decent with a mix of sun and cloud. After that, the clouds and the rain are going to be coming in, and the rest of the week is looking not terrible, but damp, with highs around 8 or 9 degrees, and very mild evenings as well, with lows only down to 6 or 7 degrees, which it really isn't bad. So, a typical winter week.
Oh, one thing I liked about the report you just aired.
Yeah.
Maybe a month or more ago, I did something about the building here with the Arthur Erickson architect was the other one, Mr. Macy. Now, one thing I didn't bring up was I wonder how people that are handicapped in wheelchairs navigate the architecture of this structure, because there's a lot of stairs and so on. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done in the past any shows about that?
Not specifically. I mean, there are elevators where you can get through to stuff. There are definitely a lack of ramps, though. There are quite a bit of stairs moving from one end of this campus to the other. And there are elevators that would allow someone in a wheelchair or not able to do stairs to navigate through. But not necessarily a lot of ramps, because the ramps weren't really a thing when most of this building was built.
Well, in 1965, I guess it wasn't as much on the radar as it is now about this. So no. There's a lot of progressive ideas put into this building in 1965. But if you're from the West Side bus station, you're definitely climbing up some stairs. And I don't know how convenient it would be. I mean, I guess you would have to be on the East Side bus loop if you're in a wheelchair on the bus or whatever, a handy dart. So I don't know. I mean, that's sort of interesting that there's navigation of it possible, but
You do kind of need to know your way. For example, if you want to get down to from any of the main pathway levels through the campus down to what's called the transportation center, which is where the buses first arrive when they come up here, or you want to get from there up to somewhere else, you have to know where the elevator is, because it isn't super obvious. There is an elevator there, which is sort of hidden under the bit near where the roadway goes through, but it's not visible, and you wouldn't necessarily it's not really that easy to spot from any of the levels where it is. It's sort of tucked into a little vestibule so I could totally see if someone arrived there and then was trying to figure out how to get up, you could be wheeling around for quite a while trying to figure out where an elevator might be, because it's not obvious.
Now, but the law court building, it was finished in 1980. It's on between Hornby and Howe, Robson area. Robson Burrard area, whatever. But I think that one has pretty good handicap access. I think that was sort of demanded, too, because it is the law courts after all.
Yeah, and I think that building went up after the time when I think awareness of this issue really came to the forefront. Because, we talked a couple weeks ago about dipped curves and how New Westminster has finally made it so every single intersection in the city has dipped curbs, so you can sort of roll off from the sidewalk level to the street level and back up again. And the mayor noted that having got to that point, now they have to go back because some of the first ones they put in aren't really up to the current standard. But that, though that movement sort of started around the 1970s, You know, and initially they just sort of ground down corners and put some asphalt to make it. But by 1980, I think that awareness was there, whereas prior to that, not so much.
And as I said, it is the provincial law courts also, so
yeah,
it's pretty well demanded that. Anyway.
All right, we have a report from our friends in Nanaimo. This is about the organization Options for Sexual Health and some challenges they're facing across the province and in Nanaimo. This is from Lauren McKenzie in CHLY in Nanaimo.
For almost 50 years, the Options for Sexual Health Clinic in Nanaimo has offered sexual and reproductive health services for all ages and genders. But now the clinic is fearing it may have to close in the next couple of months. With over 50 options for sexual health clinics across the province, it supports 14,000 people annually by offering free birth control, sexually transmitted infections or STI testing and care, pap screenings, pregnancy testing, and pregnancy option counseling. Nicole Pasquino is a registered nurse and clinical policy director for Options. She says that the clinics play an important role in remote communities where people can get needed services closer to home. As well, many of the clinics open later in the evening, allowing those who can't get care during the day to do so. But now, with the lack of necessary funding from the Provincial Health Services Authority, or PHSA, Options may have to close 85% of its clinics.
So we're funded provincially through PHSA, and with our continued stagnant funding and no contract increase over the last 12 years, we've been forced to look at our operating model and make the difficult decision of potentially closing up to 85% of our clinic services across the province.
She says that because of this, they are unable to meet the current demands of the healthcare system, especially around wages for staff, where often up to 40% of staff wages are under the current standard market of wages for nurses.
We can no longer really ethically continue to operate that way. And so we've looked at the way that we operate our service. And, you know, there's demands that are coming around electronic charting and maintaining certain standards around nurse prescribing. That's a new function for nurses that we need the dollars to be able to keep up with those. And we just can't do it anymore.
Right now, Options is looking at all 52 clinics in the province to figure out which ones will close if the funding cannot be increased. Pasquino says they are looking at individual clinics and the context within the clinic's communities while staying transparent with their staff.
It's not just the context of their communities, but it's also the availability of other services. And a lot of our rural remote clinics are places where no one else can access service. There's no other available service. Like if someone needs emergency contraception, they have to go to the emergency room, which puts a strain on the healthcare system, as you can imagine, an already strained healthcare system.
The board of directors for Options has put out a letter to the ministry looking for $800,000 in bridge funding that would keep about 50% of its clinics open and fairly compensate its staff at current livable wages. In order to continue to operate long-term at its current level, they're asking for a commitment of long-term funding for about $1.5 million a year.
From the ministry, we've given them a deadline of January 31st, and once we hear back from them, then we will be able to announce which clinics we will have to close down.
The clinic in Nanaimo serves about 1,500 to 2,000 patients every year, depending on the year, with a large patient need for STI testing and care.
The nurses in Nanaimo do a fantastic job of ensuring every patient feels welcome and getting the care that they need. And so when there's not reproductive and sexual health services around, it forces people to choose services that maybe aren't as beneficial for them, especially vulnerable populations. There's a lot of stigma related around sexual and reproductive health. So if they can't go anywhere else, then, you know, overall, we'll look at an increase in STI rates, and accessibility to contraception and cervical screening will also be impacted.
Over 50% of the patients that use Options in Nanaimo have no other healthcare provider.
One of the things that's really important to note is that, often in communities where youth is well supported, we fill the gap when people age at a youth clinic. So the people that come to Nanaimo tend to be between the 20 and 35-year-olds who just don't have family doctors or can't access their care anywhere else.
In an open letter from Options to patients and community members, it encourages supporters to contact their local MLAs and urge them to support the needed funding for the clinics. Options has also set up a webpage where people can share their stories of how the closures could impact their community.
We hear many, many stories. You know, I have patients, I see patients as well, and we have patients who come to us because they have nowhere else to go. You know, we see a lot of people who face gender-based violence, and, you know, we really don't want those patients to have to be the one that face the impact of our clinic's closing.
CHUI reached out to MLA Fort Nanaimo, Gabriel Island, Sheila Malcolmson, for comment, and was referred to the Ministry of Health. In a statement from the Ministry of Health given to CHUI, it states the ministry is, quote, grateful for the important services that Options for Sexual Health provides for thousands of people across BC. Everyone has the right to safe, compassionate, and non-judgmental sexual and reproductive care, end quote. It also states that the ministry and the Provincial Health Services Authority are, quote, continuing to work with Options for Sexual Health as well as other partners to find a pathway forward to support the delivery of care, end quote. Pasquino says it's important to consider that reproductive and sexual health care is an important part of the healthcare system.
If we do end up having to close up to 85% of our clinical services, it's going to be a huge gap in our healthcare system. And we already have a healthcare system that is overstretched and overneeded, and it will just put more impact onto that healthcare system that we just don't have any room to squeeze.
Other locations in Nanaimo where STI and HIV testing and care can be accessed are NARF's Health Matters Clinic, AVI Health and Community Services, and the Medical Arts Urgent Care Clinic. As well, a list of clinics offering reproductive health care, such as PAP testing in Nanaimo, can be found on the BC Cancer website at bccancer.bc.ca/screening/cervix. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is Bird Note. Songbirds delight us with their music, but at times they might sound repetitive. If you've ever heard a student rehearsing the same bit of music over and over again, you know the feeling. That similarity isn't a coincidence. Scientists showed that even songbirds have to practice their singing to keep performing at their best. Researchers studied birds called zebra finches. They kept several male finches in the dark for a week to discourage them from singing. Without the cue of bright light, the birds stayed quiet and their vocal muscles weakened. Then the lights came back on and the finches could sing again. The researchers recorded the finches singing after their break from practicing and compared those songs to ones recorded before the experiment. They found that female zebra finches preferred recordings of songs from before the males took a hiatus from practicing. Even after a few days off, females could tell the difference. So it seems one reason that birds repeat their songs is to keep their vocal muscles in shape. And of course, to make sure everyone hears them loud and clear. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Do you approve of that method?
Yeah, I do, Peter? Because it's something that can pertain to us. But it's funny that in the past I have heard, it's almost like a stereotype, oh, it's morning, you hear a little chirping, and it's sort of something that just tend to do, which is interesting. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's midwinter, so there's not that much bird song out there right now. But we're only
you're right. During the summertime, you would definitely hear it.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's just, it's interesting. They didn't really explain why they do it in that report. I guess it has been explained why they chirp like that.
Well, sometimes it's part of to attract a mate, or it's sort of like a form of communication.
It's almost like they just like to do it, actually, because sometimes you hear it just constantly or whatever.
Yeah. All right, Danny Nesvaradani has a report about the group Naloxone, bringing Naloxone education to high school students so they can be proactive and save lives if they're ever put in that situation.
Reporting from Burnaby, British Columbia, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Nalox Home is a nonprofit society that provides destigmatizing public education services that inform youth throughout British Columbia on how to identify the signs of an overdose and how to effectively use naloxone in the event of an overdose. Naloxone is a medication used to reverse or reduce the effects of opioids, and its usage has only increased in importance as the opioid crisis in BC has continued. This is something that was